Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme.
Something that really made me understand what was my main job. We do not design things. We do not design shapes. We do not sketch objects. We design behaviours.
We look beyond our London HQ to bring you a few urbanism stories from around the world and one that's, well, everywhere. We'll be checking in on the progress of the renovation of Sao Paulo's historic downtown, head to the coastline in South Korea to visit a new public art project, and get behind the controller to explore where urbanism and the world of gaming come together. Yes, really. And all that coming up in the next 30 minutes right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to the programme. And let's get started in Brazil. Sao Paulo is making huge strides in the revamp of its old downtown. But with Brazil being one of the hardest hit by the pandemic on the continent, how has the pace of city renovations fared? Our Latin America affairs correspondent, Lucinda Elliott, sent us this report.
In chokingly dense central São Paulo, a slow but clever reinvention of Brazil's business capital has been taking place for several years. What was, for at least a generation, a downtown area to avoid, with semi-abandoned buildings, congested highways and the homeless, the Centro has been revived, with a serious reconsideration of how public space is used in this socially divided city of 12 million people. The change was perhaps marked for many by the opening in late 2017 of the SESC 24 de Maio, a 13-storey purpose-built venue with an art gallery, dental clinic, rooftop public swimming pool and children's play areas, to name but a few amenities. The space, in the heart of downtown, aimed to try and heal the huge social disparities in this district of São Paulo by opening something that could, in theory, be used by all.
Um novo polo cultural acaba de ser inaugurado na cidade de São Paulo.
Dozens of restaurants, pavement-side bars, boutiques and restored covered markets have sprung up since, attracting more Paulistas to rent flats in the area again, bringing their own initiatives that, for the most part, are privately funded. My grandmother, who lived in the city throughout the 90s and early 2000s, was amazed when I told her about a new venture by the busy Minhocão overpass that opened this May. Downstairs is a new bookshop, Gato Sem Rabo, dedicated exclusively to female authors, with several dining options above. It got me thinking about what the pandemic had done to the rhythm of renovations in the Centro. With so many businesses forced to shutter, had they managed to hang on? And are the sunnier changes lasting? Rafael Capobianco runs a new rooftop restaurant, Cora, as part of the building beside the Minhocão. The views, long closed to the public, are pretty impressive from Amaral Gurgel Street. He explained how, in fact, the Centro's renovation is solidifying and expanding as a result of the health crisis, with offers to be had on properties and residents pulling together to make projects financially viable.
Right now, we're finally starting to see what the revitalization in this new center is going to look like. Because for us that live in São Paulo for a long time, it's like almost a legend. Oh, the center is going to be the next big thing. It's going to be a very nice living area. It's going to be revitalized, it's going to be safe, blah, blah, blah. But it never happened, for sure, because people didn't get it. You don't gentrificate an area to make it better. You must make it better for the people that are already there. And that's what we're doing somehow. We are creating business in buildings that have been there for so many times and bringing a new meaning to this building, requalificating these buildings as they improve the economy and the people that live in the area can consume in this business. So the rents don't get higher because a very modern building is next door. But the quality of life is actually better. I mean, it's small steps, but I definitely see a brighter future for the region. It was actually essential for the success that we could do this together. I mean, it was pretty hard, that's sure. But when you have people on your side that are struggling but can support you not only emotionally or psychologically or even financially, but with customers also. Because there's a really nice trade-off between Gatsinghab with the bookstore, the pizzeria, even the other renters like galleries or co-working spaces that also occupies the building. Because we consume each other business, of course. So it was pretty important. It definitely helped so we could get through these rough times.
Before they moved in this year, the building had been abandoned for 2 decades. Schemes to close off main roads to traffic on weekends, like the busy highway out front, had revealed offices and apartment blocks in a serious state of disrepair on either side. There was an opportunity. By clubbing together, led in part by bookshop owner Joanna Stein and her female-only writer's store, the building, that has kept its graffiti, is drawing a really varied crowd, with plenty of room for further restorations nearby. Not that any form of change has been easy, explained Raphael. There's still little to no help from the council, and poverty is evident and on the rise. He'd been part of the ambitious early arrivals to the Saint-Through, with a bar, Caracol.
We are a bar, we work at night, we have live music. So everything that the pandemic could kill, it tried to kill in our business, because people getting together on their feet, like not sitting down, talking very near each other, dancing a little bit. That was our core. That's what Caracol meant. So we had to shut down for 6 months, and we struggled a lot on the beginning of this comeback. But I could say that at the end of things, we did pretty well. We kept all our employees. We also changed the business face a little bit, so we could be less a club, less a nightclub, and more a bar and a dining space. So I think we come out of it better than we were before, stronger than we were before, but it was hard times, definitely. I really hope the government could help us a little bit more, giving us the infrastructure that we need so we can grow our business and the people around this business can also enjoy these improvements, you know? Supposedly, when the Miocão turns into a park, there's going to be a lot of improvements in this area. It's also authorized in the city hall, but so far nothing has been done. I mean, little improvements, but there's also a lot to be done yet.
In a world where social divisions in cities are widening, the Saint-Through shows how residents want areas to evolve, come together, and feel accessible. If they can get through a pandemic with such energy and drive, then there's every sign that these important transformations are here to stay. For Monocle, in Latin America, I'm Lucinda Elliott.
Thank you, Lucinda. Stay with us because next, we're off to South Korea, right here on The Urbanist. Let's continue now in the coastal city of Busan, which has debuted a large urban intervention along the waterfront of Suyeong District. Designed by the Italian practice Migliore and Cerveto Architects, it takes over 500 metres of a former water park and, together with local artists and art galleries, has turned it into a colourful, textured pattern which brings the dark asphalt to life. The project is called Waterfront Door into the Ocean and invites residents and visitors to play with the space and think of public areas in a city as a collective home. Earlier, Monocle's Carlos Rabello caught up with the Praxis co-founder, the architect Ikko Migliore, to find out more about the project, his connection with South Korea, and the inspiration behind the shapes and bright colours created.
We did several things in South Korea. I'm also a professor in the university there, Busan, the city of Busan, a very interesting design school. It's called Dongseo University in South of Korea. And there was a competition organised by the Minister of Culture, in Korea, of course, in the city of Busan, to transform cities in order to design public art projects for, especially after the pandemic. And then we were involved in this project and we had the chance to win, so we were very lucky for that. And then we developed the project, of course.
Now, the photos are quite striking, looking at these images of this amazing, colourful pattern around the waterfront. Maybe let's try to take the difficult task of describing into words the visuals. And tell me a bit more about, you know, the inspiration for the project and what visitors can see now.
So this is sort of a new pattern for people to get in touch with the nature, to understand and to experiment a new relationship between nature and, of course, the sea. It's a beautiful sea. So this is a park. It used to be a sea park, right, where you can meet animals and so there. But it was not in use anymore because of the pandemic. And we redesigned that, of course, with local artists. The good thing that we work with 37 local artists, and they redesigned the apply, my sketches, our sketches. And also, we provide job for them and to cover almost 4,000 square meters of this long installation, which is about 500 meters long. And how it's conceived? It's conceived like starting from the idea of shapes and thematic areas from which a sort of a additional sign and various scales spread out in the space is a sort of a place in which to give a new narration of the area. Of course, a connection between nature and people there, and with many colors, with many, many different subjects. And this is the way the pattern was conceived.
Public art has been used in many cities around the world and throughout many years. But particularly now after the pandemic, we've seen similar examples here in London where public art, particularly when it comes to the asphalt or the ground with installations, is used to attract people back into the city. We've been all inside our homes for so many months that it's a way of encouraging movement again. This was, of course, part of your thinking when conceiving this project as well.
Yes, of course. But we want to maintain the social distancing. We want to emphasize this, but without being restricted in squares or in circles. We want more to also have a possibility for them to measure the space. And this is also one thing. And also to make them dream a little bit more. So this kind of a temporary urban graphics, I think, is something more connected to the storytelling. So the kids visiting this area, they can open up their imagination. And the result, place in which we invite people to inhabit it more. So it becomes a sort of a wealth to discover and story to open the imagination of people visiting the place. So we started from the idea of distances among people, but then transforming that into a new way of storytelling. And this, I think, is quite interesting because we have the reference, like we have, you know, I think in every country we have storytellers where they used to sing with instruments and usually guitar or accordion, telling stories about what happened. We transformed that area almost into something like a theater. And they were helped themselves with a sort of a poster which, you know, depicted story, describing the main scenes. With this, we have those scenes, like the sceneries that we design on this pathway. And for people, to meeting mystery and love of the nature, to meeting sound of the nature, to meeting stories. This is the key factor for us. So we tried to transform, I would say, Italo Calvino, you know, the very important Italian writer. He wrote that Invisible Cities, which is a very important book. He wrote that cities are like dreams, built of desire and fears. So this is something we want to, in a light way, according to the problems that we have now with pandemic, but also at the same time revitalize a beautiful area like this one in Busan.
Well, as an architect, you're often responsible not only for telling the story of a city, but for being part of it as well. You know, a project of yours can become, you know, part of the city's story for the future. So it's really poetic the way you're describing this project with that in mind. So I'm curious if you feel that in this particular project, are you helping write the story of the city and are you part of it? Do you feel that way?
I think any architect, any designer, especially if we work like urban graphic, I would say, we just open up the possibility to this kind of a slow metamorphosis. Our design is never conceived as an ended story, as something that really or should be open, should be an environment conception of the design. And it will be transformed, slowly transformed. And I think I'm very much interested in those kind of a possible metamorphosis that we can suggest to the inhabitants and to the people living there. So they behave in another way. So just a suggestion, I think, through this kind of interventions. And I think, especially in this case that we, as I said before, fears and desires are probably something that we have to meet in our cities. I think the idea is sometimes when we design something that is safe, sometimes when you say something, in many cases, safe doesn't mean aesthetic. Many times when we design something conceived to be safe, to be sure in the city, we design borders, barriers, obstacles with no idea of connection, but a separation. We try to have this kind of a conception of designing this safe place just by connecting more the people to each other. So not just taking them apart, but connecting them. So this is the main subject. And I think this kind of a open metamorphosis on the pathway that I think is interesting. In our idea, I mean, I did 2 years ago an exhibition that was called We All Live in Patterns, because, I mean, it's the research aimed to the reflection on the concept, the value of the role of patterns in our surroundings, especially with the current topic. And I think this idea of redesigning pathways, redesigning a pattern, is very much connected to the idea of having the city as a collective home. We have to conceive open spaces as a collective home in which we can inhabit it, the city, just by putting the same attention, almost like an interior design. So to treat it with the same caliber level of care as the city are our collective home in which we live, in which we share things, we connect, we meet everything, we meet our identity, our story, our heritage. I think this is the most important fact, I think, nowadays, especially after the pandemic, we understood that how important is our neighborhood, how we can really take advantage by having a city well conceived as a sort of a nest for everyone to live, with cocoons or area in which I can have a, you know, rest, or I can, I mean, places in which I like to go, I like to spend time outside. Conceive with the same idea as a private home.
Iko, you described the city in a way that is close to our hearts here on The Urbanist, this idea that cities benefit from difference, from different people, different cultures, different buildings, from this intersection and exchange of experiences and of lives. And seeing this pattern also bringing a lot of these textures onto the pavement in Busan is really fascinating and really inspiring. I guess the final question I have for you is, do you ever have expectations of how people will interact with your designs when you're doing something public? One thing is different when we're talking about a building, but in a project like this, when it's on the public realm, do you expect any particular way that people will interact with the space? Or is your job to be like, enjoy it however you want? My task here is done.
I think that one thing that I learned also teaching at University in Milano, the School of Design, my mentor was Achille Castiglioni, you know, the great designer. Actually, is the reason why I'm doing this job. And he said to me, oh, trust me, we do not sketch objects. We design behaviors. So something that really made me understand what was my main job. We do not design things. We do not design shapes. We design behavior. But those behaviors are transformed by our visitors. So we try to transform this criticality, which is COVID, this criticality, into a sort of an opportunity, quite open. And I think our object, our design, our intervention should be open to be transformed, almost like you have a script in theater and the actors, they perform the way they like in a better way. So it's something that we just give a guideline for people to be transformed. I think this is more interesting. They can transform what you have done in a new, in a better way.
Iko Milori, co-founder of Milori and Servetto Architects there, in conversation with Monocle's Carlotta Ribello. And finally, well, we're going to cross the vast expanse of the digital world and explore how one of the world's biggest video gaming companies is using its computing power for good and helping the architectural world turn its plans into virtual reality. Monocle 24's David Stevens investigates.
I remember having a conversation with a friend who's also an architect, and we were talking actually about Assassin's Creed, which, you know, is a computer game. And we'd read an article where game developers were monitoring where players were interacting in Assassin's Creed and using that data to better, you know, design the world or better help them figure out, you know, how to make the world more enjoyable to its players. And me and my friend were thinking, wow, that's insane. They're using this digital model and this digital experience to help them sort of design and sort of build out. You know, why are we not doing that as architects? Why are we not doing that in the architecture industry?
The ultimate goal of technology is to improve the human experience. When it comes to video games, this improved experience is often reduced to a fun way to kill time or a touch of escapism. But video games and the building blocks behind them can, for the right person, unlock an endlessly generating horizon of opportunities in the architecture and planning space too.
My name is David Wormacall, and I am the AEC Business Development Manager at Epic Games.
David works in the so-called non-games side of the video game company Epic Games, which encompasses a number of industries from media to automotive to architecture and design. So how can a game company be of use in the non-games arena? It all comes down to the building blocks or engines that they use to create their worlds. In an Epic Games case, that's called the Unreal Engine.
The best way to describe it is it's this toolbox that you can build up and be one of many different things. So a lot of different game developers use it to create their own games. We also license out that game engine that we use for our games to other game companies. And then we also license it out to the non-game side of it, which would obviously be the architecture, engineering, construction community, the automotive, media and entertainment. And it's used in actually relatively the same way. It's still this toolbox that users from any industry can basically go into and package up and create these, we'll call them gamified experiences at this point, and deploy them. Now, because it's a toolbox, there are these amazing sort of additions that you can sort of attach onto it or plug into it that allow you to extend or add additional functionality into it. And one of those is a great plugin called Cesium. Now, Cesium basically create these amazing 3D world tiles based off of GIS data. So it's this world terrain, you know, photogrammetry buildings. And rather than maybe the more traditional way that, you know, we know in architecture for importing models into programs, which is a very static, you know, you take a large file and you import that, and then you've got an even larger file and you keep building on top of that larger file, and then you've got a humongous file. Cesium works in Unreal by streaming in the geometry from their database. So rather than loading in these assets, depending on where you are geographically in the world, it will only load in all the data from that area. So it's an amazing way that you can have access to a global database of GIS, photogrammetry, LiDAR, BIM, but keeping your package size of your application really, really small.
While your youthful hours wandering the worlds of Sonic the Hedgehog might not have entirely schooled you up on all of that architecture jargon, it is curious to explore how something created for the video game universe has come to be so useful to architects and planners.
The architecture side of the business, it was actually a very organic growth. It was never something I think that was originally highly targeted. But what happened was we had this game engine that was being used, and because of its output and because of the functionality of how the games industry works, it was started to be used for people to basically utilize what we call the real-time rendering aspect of game engines. And so real-time rendering is basically, depending on where you're coming from in the architecture industry, you may be more familiar with this kind of static architectural renders where you press a button and you go away and have a coffee and dinner and come back 4 hours later and you have a lovely visual. Real-time rendering is this constantly rendered 3D world. And so that started to be used in a number of different areas for communication, for collaboration. And this is where it kind of struck gold in the architecture community. And it was because of that organic growth within that visualization community who embraced the game engine, who embraced the capabilities of what it could do. And it then started to spread to, well, what else can it do? And the second that you could start to be more immersed in your digital world, that's when the whole industry started to take note and started to look at, well, how could we use this in design? How could we use this as a way of engaging our customers, our clients, our stakeholders, our consumers, and actually bring them into the process?
A virtual world-building toolbox is allowing blueprints to jump off the page and allowing the general public to be able to engage with plans in a much more real way before they're implemented. The Unreal Engine and its collection of plugins allows planners to place people within projects and place projects in front of people in a way that they understand to give them meaningful feedback.
Imagine being able to put a client in an immersive virtual world of their new development, knowing where they go, what they look at, how long they spend in different positions, but more importantly for architecture, you know, where didn't they go? What weren't they looking at that maybe you wanted them to look at? You know, did my amazing fountain at the front of the building, you know, attract people's eyes, or did it attract attention, or did it just fall dud? You know, if we replace that with a sculpture, if we replace that with a different facade, does that have an impact on how people digitally interact? So what we're, and lots of people are looking at this, is how those digital experiences pertain to the real world. And what I mean by that is me walking around in VR, how accurate is that to me walking around in real life? You know, it's not 100% accurate. You know, we can't say, well, David jumped in a fountain in VR, and so that's exactly what we can expect him to do in the real world. Well, of course not. But in general, there is a correlation between how we work digitally and how we work in the physical world. And that allows us this amazing opportunity to actually run prototypes and get insight into our designs prior to getting them built. Because I think there's this common understanding that, you know, every new building is a prototype. We haven't built it before, so we don't know how it's going to run. So imagine having a little bit of insight into how that would work.
So what are some of the planning nightmares that this digital form of world building is uniquely poised to solve?
There's lots of different areas that we've seen people use the engines to address problems, from using VR for spatial awareness, you know, how big of space is, you know, you say something is, you know, 35 foot long, you know, to me that is, oh, I have no idea what 35 feet is. So being able to see it virtually is kind of a way to quickly understand that in a spatial context. But I'd say our biggest problem that we really solve is this idea of visual communication and this idea of collaboration on a virtual level. In the architecture space, one of the biggest problems that I think we are facing is how do we convey our ideas, how do we convey our designs to people who are not architecturally inclined, you know, those who have not had degrees, you know. And so whenever you put it into a context that people understand, which is, you know, a 3D environment, something that is contextually relevant to them, it starts to allow you to bridge that conversation. And so that's the problem that 3D real-time and game engines and all these plugins are all really working at, is being able to say, well, here is your new building. You know, here is it in context. Here is the view from your house to that new building. Here's the impact of this. This is a solar study, the sun that comes in, so the shade that it's going to create. This is the, what the materials will look like. So, you know, it's always about bringing people together. It's about communicating and visually showing something that before we maybe didn't have that ability to do.
One of the major trends in video games over the last decade has been the emergence of titles which allow the user to create and build. Games like Epic's very own Fortnite or the widely popular Minecraft from Mojang Studios offer building materials at the touch of a controller, and could also be building the next generation of architects too.
I am really excited and also slightly terrified about the generation that's fastly coming up behind me. Firstly, because they've grown up with this technology. They've got this understanding of this sort of contextual 3D world that, you know, I often refer to as being, well, these are your future clients. These are your future general public. You know, these kids that have grown up in Fortnite or in Minecraft, you know, have this expectation and understanding of the world that is 3D. Even in the sense that I think whenever COVID hit and we all suddenly went into virtual communication, you know, we all jumped into Zoom, or we all started exploring these different virtual collaboration platforms where, you know, you're running around as avatars. Everyone struggled. The industry struggled. You know, it's like, this isn't natural. We like our face-to-face. We like catching up over a cup of coffee. And I was like, man, do you want to know a generation that doesn't really need that, that find virtual collaboration, communication just as easy as visual? And that's the generation that are growing up with Minecraft and with Fortnite. You know, they know how to communicate and interact and socialize virtually. And they love it. So whereas it's tough for us, it's very easy for them. And that's similar in the way that they design and that they think. And you see it in universities and you see it in educational institutes and architecture now, where there's a lot more 3D and a lot more immersive style of designing now than there ever was. And they're really the ones that are leading the way for what we call the next gen architect.
It seems that despite its computer screen glow, the future of urban design is looking bright. For Monocle, I'm David Stevens.
That's all for this edition of The Urbanist, but before you go, I have an invitation. Next week, Monocle 24 is celebrating 10 years on air, and we couldn't have done it without you, the listener. To mark this special occasion, we're hosting the Monocle Media Summit here in London on Thursday, the 14th of October. It's a packed afternoon of panels with a live radio show and a glass or two to celebrate as well. We'd love to see you there, and as a thank you for your loyalty over the years, all you have to do is enter the code M24BIRTHDAY at our website to receive a 10% discount exclusive to our listeners on the ticket price. All details can be found at monocle.com. But for now, that's it from the Urbanist team. As usual, today's episode was produced by Carlo Tarabello and by David Stevens, and David also edited the show. And to play you out of this week's episode, well, here's A Flock of Seagulls with I Ran So Far Away. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.